All right. This committee will come to order. And members, just an announcement before we get started here. If anybody on this committee that is not on finance and want a budget book, we have some. That you'll have to take up with Huntley. Yes.
So if we had one and they took it,
we can't have one. Well, yeah, I'll have to find it somewhere else. Yeah. So if you're interested, please do that. All right. Rude will move the minutes.
Yep.
All right, President Rude moves the minutes of the January 29th meeting. Any questions? All in favor of adopting those minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Representative Knuth. House File 250. And does anybody want to move? Representative Murphy, do you want to move the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move House File 250, have it re-referred to...
Environment Policy.
Environment Policy.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. We have several testifiers on this bill, and I don't actually know their order, but I was just going to do a quick introduction and answer questions after our testifiers.
Do you want to just put on your author's amendment right away so we get it
sure.
in the order that...
Sure.
You want to move the amendment?
Chair, thank you. I would move the H2 amendment.
Okay, this is just to get the bill in the order the author wants it. Any discussion? All in favor of adopting the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. So, whatever order you want to proceed in, Representative Knuth.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the bill I'm bringing before you, House File 250, the Toxic Free Kids Act, is trying to get at some of the issues and concerns I have and are developing around the country and the world about toxic chemicals that are found both in our products and in ourselves and in our environment. And actually just this past week, the Government Accountability Office came out with their biennial high risk list, where they're looking at places where the federal government needs to be stepping up, and they highlighted that the EPA is not assessing or regulating toxic chemicals and to limit public exposure to many chemicals that may actually pose substantial health risks. And I think there should be something in your packet talking about this. There's both an article and then an actual document from the GAO. So I want to make sure that Minnesotans have adequate information to protect our health from toxic chemicals and products in our environment. And we want to start with our youngest people, those who are most susceptible to toxic chemicals, and that's our children, and children being defined as people 12 and under, and children's products meant for those people. So the bill evaluates chemicals and then has them reported back and then sets up a system to find safer alternatives and then phase them out. And so we're looking to classify chemicals of high concern that cause cancer, reproductive toxins, endocrine or hormone disruption, persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic. And then after we identify this list of chemicals of high concern, we're looking for priority chemicals, basically chemicals that are found in humans, in our home environments, or in our natural fish, wildlife, and our natural environment. Or else they're high production or they're banned in another state. And then after that, we're asking manufacturers, and this is important, we're not asking retailers, we're asking manufacturers, distributors, to report on whether or not this chemical is in their children's products, and then whether or not we can use safer alternatives to replace these chemicals. And if there is a safer alternative, we could take action to ban it. That's several years out, and it's not the main part of this bill. It could be a result of this bill, but I think we're looking for better information and looking to find better chemicals to use in our products. There are some exemptions which you can go through, or if you have questions, we can talk about that. then also participate in an interstate chemical clearinghouse that's been sent up by the University of Massachusetts Lowell. And then we're asking our PCA in consultation with our Health Department and Commerce Department to report back with a couple different reports. One is on implementing that priority chemical part of the legislation, and then also about how we can evaluate and regulate toxic chemicals in across our commerce, and making sure it's, we're starting with kids because they're the most susceptible, but we also want information about how and how this could be done well in other areas. And I think that with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kathleen Sula from Healthy Legacy.
Thank you. And just right before we start, members, one thing we want to, I'd like to do with your cooperation is, you know, there's kind of a health environmental piece of this, and then there's a commerce piece of this. I'd like to focus on the health side of it and not kind of get into the commerce effects, because it will be going to Environment and Commerce Committee and a variety of things. So just because we only have an hour to accept this question.
Process question. Do you know, or maybe Representative Knuth knows, does this also go to Ag Committee? I mean, I'm looking with the amendment, and the amendment would imply to me that this has got to go to the Ag Committee too. Is that the path that your understanding this would need to go?
My intention was not to have it go through the Ag Committee, and I, you know, I will talk with the chair of the committee. He's on the next committee that this bill will go to, and you know, we can look at ways to make sure it's got several stops, and environmental policy is the next one.
Mr. Chair, yes, Representative, I hope that you have a strong discussion with them, because I know that that issue has been strongly debated in the Agriculture Committee, and I would expect that they. The chair and actually members from our side of the aisle would want to see that as well. So thank you.
I'm not, Mr. Chair, Senator Broad, I'm not sure which issue.
Mr. Chairman, in the amendment, they're talking about endocrine disruptors, and I know that that's been a heavily debated topic in the Ag Committee.
And I think we're going to be sending it to the Environment Committee. If there is something... If you're concerned that some issue related to that won't get covered, if you can certainly have some discretion here to ask the questions too, and then we'll deal with where it goes after Environment. Someone else will decide that. So, okay, please go ahead.
My name is Kathleen Schuler, and I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. I'm also co-director of Healthy Legacy, which is a statewide public health coalition. And Healthy Legacy is a coalition of 30 groups, including diverse groups like the Minnesota Public Health Association, the Minnesota Nurses Association, the Minnesota Council of Churches, the State PTA, Learning Disability Association, ARC, and many others. Why is this a public health problem? This is a public health problem because chemicals in our everyday consumer products expose children and adults to unnecessary exposures. The fact that this is a public health problem is affirmed by a resolution by the American Public Health Association that advocates for green chemistry and for reform of our chemical policy system. The Minnesota Public Health Association also has a similar resolution, and there's a letter of support from them in your packet. We also have several other letters of support that we've provided from our coalition. Why are we dealing with this problem at the state level? We're dealing with this problem at the state level because, as Representative Knuth pointed out in the recent GAO report, points out that the federal government has failed to regulate chemicals in industrial chemicals. And just to clarify, this does not cover agricultural chemicals at all, even though some agricultural chemicals are hormone disruptors. This basically is just consumer products. The 30-year-old regulation of our industrial chemical system is the Toxic Substances Control Act. It was enacted in 1976. And since it was enacted, it has the EPA, the agency in charge, has required chemical safety testing on only 20 chemicals, and only 5 chemicals have been phased out under TSCA. TSCA is failing to protect the public from this unnecessary risk. The Toxic Free Kids Act offers a systematic way to evaluate chemicals in children's products as a way of addressing this problem. The Pollution Control Agency has pointed out would consult with the Department of Health and develop a list of priority chemicals. There's a lot of chemicals used in commerce. There's 80,000 chemicals, and we're not asking the agency to deal with 80,000 chemicals. That would be impossible. We're looking at the ones that are of high concern, that are at risk to the public, that persist and get into the environment and get into our bodies. For states that have already put lists together, for example, Maine and Washington have similar legislation, they've come up with a list of 1,500 chemicals that are high concern, that have these properties that would be a risk to human health. And those that are in children's products would be narrowed down to between 50 and 80 chemicals. So we're not talking about a daunting task here. This is something that's doable. And the bill requires or would ask the Pollution Control Agency to come up with these priority lists, but not to implement it, as Representative Knuth pointed out, until there was a report back to the legislature on how everything would be funded. And then the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse, which the Pollution Control Agency has signed on to, would be a tool that's available to assist the state in compiling this information and in evaluating the safety of alternatives. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, members? Okay, thank you. There will probably be some other questions after the next testifier. Representative Knuth, you...
Yes, the next testifier is John Peterson Myers, and I think in your packet you should have his bio. He can give you a little background, but he's much more of an expert than any of us on the health effects of some of these chemicals and some of the background for why we're bringing this bill forward.
And welcome, Mr. Myers. And just members, Mr. Myers is going to talk about the bill and the process and the toxic chemicals, and then spend actually a little bit of time specifically on BPA, because we're going to be having another bill on that later, but he's in town today and won't be later. So we're going to just touch on that piece of it at the end, I think.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity. It's an honor to be here. I'm John Peterson Myers, Pete Myers. I'm Chief Scientist of Environmental Health Sciences, science-based not-for-profit in Charlottesville, Virginia. I've been working on these issues for a couple decades. I'm going to talk about a revolution in science that's underway today as a result of some really dramatic advances in research into these issues. And this revolution in science creates the framework for considering a bill of this nature. I want to begin with an observation and actually also a metaphor that will help understand the urgency and the context of this new science. The observation is that if you talk to just about any public health official today, they will tell you that today's children are the first generation of children in centuries who are likely to be less healthy than their parents. That is a serious issue. The metaphor is one that builds off of that, and it relates the health of children to the health of adults. I want you to think for a moment that you are the Coast Guard. I know this sounds a little silly, but think about being the Coast Guard, and your responsibility is to make sure that the ship makes it across the ocean to the port, from New York to London. And think about that in terms of the developmental course of a child from birth through to old age. The traditional Coast Guard, to protect that child from harm, from toxicological harm, would ask, where are the bombers and how are they going to blow up that ship? That's how old toxicology has approached these issues. New toxicology asks a very different type of question. It asks, is the compass on course, or is it 1 or 2 degrees off course? Because it's 1 or 2 degrees off course by the time that boat makes it across the ocean, or by the time we reach middle or old age, we could be headed towards a really serious health condition. So the direction that fetal development and early childhood development takes, even though the difference in course might be very subtle at birth, it could have profound consequences as someone ages. And this whole new science is built upon a couple of key concepts, one of which is called the developmental origins, the fetal origins of adult disease. Okay? So, where does that take us? We are midstream in this revolution that looks at factors affecting fetal and childhood development. And that revolution is causing profound changes in how we think about how contaminants, even at low levels, might affect human health and could possibly alter adult health as well. It's leading to unexpected discoveries about materials we thought were safe, materials that are in common consumer products, that in fact, old toxicology using insensitive assays had said it's not a problem, but this new science is saying actually it may be a problem. The important thing about this, though, is that it's telling us there are opportunities to prevent disease that we have not yet seen. This science is actually, while at first a little daunting, it's really exciting because it's telling us we have the opportunity to prevent some serious diseases if we act upon this new science. That's the really exciting part of this. What does it mean? Well, right now what we're learning is that traditional toxicology, the ways that scientists have gone about assessing what's safe and what's not, they're highly likely to have underestimated the effect of low-dose exposures on human health. But what we know is that as we bring the regulatory approaches into a state that they reflect this new science, we know that medicine, product design, epidemiology, toxicology can do a much better job at protecting people, and people will be healthier as we act upon it. There are four key discoveries in this new science. One of them is that some contaminants at very low levels can alter the ways that genes behave. They don't cause mutations. They don't blow the genes up, but they alter when they're turned on and off. Second, high-dose experiments, the traditional tests that we have used to determine is this safe or not, those high-dose experiments we're learning under certain circumstances are very bad at predicting what happens as a result of low-dose chronic exposure. Thirdly, mixtures are everywhere. Mixtures of chemicals, they interact in ways that traditional toxicology has not even begun to grapple with, yet we know that they are consequential, those mixtures. And finally, as I mentioned at the outset, adult chronic diseases can be programmed during development in ways that lead fetal events to have serious effects on people even as they're entering old age. I can tell three parts of this story with this one slide. You can see on the slide that you can see on your right, there's an obese mouse. On your left, there's a thin mouse. Those mice are the same strain of mouse. This is an experiment done at the National Institute of Health by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. They monitor the caloric intake of these animals through life. They monitor their activity levels, and the activity levels and the caloric intake were the same. What's the difference between the two mice? And the experimental group on your right and the control group on your left. Well, the experimental group was exposed right at birth to a very small amount of a powerful synthetic estrogen called diethyl sylvestrol. This is a model system that's used to experiment with what are the consequences of exposing things to exposing people and animals to estrogens, estrogenic substances, hormone-disrupting compounds. Diethyl sylvestrol is just one example of a compound that can cause events like this. So the mouse exposed to one part per billion of DES right at birth became grotesquely obese in adulthood. We think we know why that's happening, although there's still tests unfolding. But what we think is happening is that that small amount of DES, and BPA can do the same thing, bisphenol A, that small amount causes stem cells to be more likely to become fat cells, which increases the risk of obesity. It's not certain, but that's the clear implication of current molecular genetics looking into that. Here's the conundrum, however. What happens when you expose the mouse to a lot of DES? It becomes thinner in old age. It doesn't become fatter, it becomes thinner. So high-dose experiments tell you to look for weight loss. Low-dose experiments actually produce weight gain. So thirdly, the third part of this story is that developmental exposure, these were exposures right around birth, lead to obesity in adulthood. So the three key pieces of that are low doses matter, high-level tests don't predict low-level effects. In fact, they predict just the opposite in this case. And early life exposures can impair adult health. Well, if you step back and you ask, where does this come from? Where does this science emanate from? It comes from the genetic basis of many human diseases. And most people, when they hear me say that, they say, what? You were just talking about environment, and there you're talking about genetic basis, okay? And the reason why that's not wrong, the reason why that's a key insight, is that most of us confuse the two different ways you have to think about what it means for a disease to be based upon genes. One is heredity. It does matter what genes you get from your parents. But it turns out that genes are sort of like nature's nanotechnology. They're being turned on and off literally trillions of times a second. If they aren't, and they're making proteins and other things that we need to grow properly and to maintain ourselves properly. If genes aren't turned on or off at the right time, you've got problems. The term of art is gene expression. What changes gene expression? Well, it does matter whether you've got the right gene in the first place. And it turns out genes are talking to one another all the time, sending hormonal signals back and forth among one another. But also, classic factors of the environment alter gene expression, including diet, stress, experience, and environmental contaminants. That's where the term hormone disruption, endocrine disruption, comes in, because they're interfering with the signals that genes are sending from amongst one another. We look specifically at environmental contaminants that we now know can alter gene expression. You see a growing list that includes bisphenol A, the perfluorinated compounds, phthalates, the flame retardants, etc. The list is growing longer. What this does is, remember that old dichotomy you learned in high school biology, genes versus environment, nature versus nurture? Well, it flips that dichotomy on its head, okay? It does matter what genes you get from your parents, but the environmental factors that determine when those genes are turned on and off are absolutely central to influencing your health. So, this new way of looking at the interaction between genes and the environment is forcing a series of conceptual shifts into the field of toxicology. We used to think that a disease that was under genetic, that was linked to a gene, so how many of you have read within the last 6 months a story about the Human Genome Project, where they say schizophrenia is linked to a gene, diabetes is linked to a gene? Most of us react to that by saying, oh my God, did I get the wrong gene from my parents? Well, I react to that very differently. Because I know that there might be some environmental factor that, in fact, is changing that gene's expression. And the reason why that's important is because that then identifies a potential avenue of intervention. It says, actually, we might be able to prevent some portion of that disease burden by identifying the environmental factor and going in and reducing exposure. That's a really key shift in how you think about diseases that are linked to genes. We used to think that only high levels matter. Now we know that for certain contaminants, there are effects at everyday levels. Levels that people have become inured into thinking of, that's just background. Levels that chemists couldn't even measure 20 years ago. I'm going to show you a picture, and I know, it. Fortunately, it's a long time after lunch, and it's a long time before dinner. It's the inside of a mouse. This is a normal mouse. You can look, and you can see what the next one is with your cheat sheet there. But this is a control mouse. It's about my age in mouse years. Okay, and it's got kidneys that look great, it's got a bladder that looks wonderful, it's a male, it has testes. What happens if that mouse in the womb is exposed to 20 parts per billion bisphenol A during development in the womb? 20 parts per billion. Well, here's what it grows up to at my age in mouse years. If that animal had been allowed to age for two or three more days, its bladder literally would have exploded. Its kidneys are already necrotic, they're not functional anymore. And what happened was this. Think about that boat that's going across the ocean. Right at first, right in this space, right early during fetal development, when exposure took place, or when the boat's leaving the harbor, there were changes in the control factors determining when certain genes could be turned on and off. They were set in place, and as the animal aged, These control factors were in a specific place in the urethra, which is the tube that connects the bladder to the outside world. There were specific places that where the way that those genes were responding to hormonal signals was changed for the life of the animal. And as it grew, the urethra gradually grew shut until it could no longer pee by the time it was this old. Really an amazing result, which represents the sort of new insight into how environmental factors affecting gene expression can alter the course of development in ways that lead to serious health consequences through the life of an animal. And this is well, we now know we can detect the types of changes that they're called epigenetic changes in the control mechanisms that control the gene expression. We can detect those right at birth. Traditional toxicology never would have looked for them, didn't know how to look for them. This is all 21st century science. Another new bisphenol A result. Should I stop the question?
No,
I'm sorry.
Okay. Question of that. Do you have a question now?
Just kidding, no more.
Okay. So another new DCLA result also reflecting information that's emerging this year about the consequences of low-level exposure to this particular compound is a study that was just published this September in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, the premier journal of American medicine. And it shows that slight increases in levels of bisphenol A in American blood are associated with strong increases in the risk of cardiovascular disease, angina, coronary heart disease, heart attack, and type 2 diabetes. And type 2 diabetes, you probably know, is an extremely consequential, all of these are extremely consequential, type 2 diabetes costs this country about $218 billion a year in healthcare costs. And so think what this means. If we have identified an opportunity to begin to intervene with a major disease like this, we not only may be able to help reduce the burden, the human burden of these diseases, we may actually have a material effect on the cost of healthcare in this country. How did regulatory toxicology mix this and these types of events, these types of problems? Well, regulatory toxicology reflects science literally, it's based upon principles that come out of the 16th century. It's not based upon 21st century science. It assumes, first of all, that there is a safe dose at which, below which exposure doesn't matter. Maybe true for some compounds, but actually scientists can tell you that it's not true for all compounds. It also assumes that the shape of the dose response curve, how the response increases as the dose increases, it assumes that it's either linear or that it always continues to go up. But we're learning, and frankly, if there are any medical endocrinologists in the room, you'll know this is true. Medical endocrinology has known that hormones at one level will turn on one set of genes, and at another level will turn on a completely different set of genes. So you can't predict from high-dose experiments what set of genes are going to be turned on at low doses from those high doses. It just doesn't work. And so you wind up with dose response curves like the ones on the right. Those are called non-monotonic dose response curves. So that assumption of the effect always increases with the dose leads to the assumption that we can predict low dose effects from high dose testing. That's the basis of regulatory toxicology. The problem is,
and just I think we're gonna have to about 5 more minutes if we can just speak.
Okay.
More. Thank you.
Great. I
apologize. This is fascinating.
Thank you very much. And I want to make sure I show you one additional graph in here. These assumptions, as they are applied in regulatory toxicology, are not tested. And let me give you an example of how this works. If you could flip ahead to this slide. How many of you know what tamoxifen is? Most of the women here know what tamoxifen is, many of the men. Tamoxifen is a pharmaceutical agent that's used to treat breast cancer. And the reason why it's used to treat breast cancer is seen on the far right of that graph. That graph is showing how different levels of tamoxifen affect the growth of breast cancer tumors in vitro, in lab experiments. These are human breast cancer cells that have been removed. And then experiments are done in the lab. And you can see it at high doses, parts per thousand, which is a therapeutic dose, the growth of the tumor is suppressed. That looks great. The problem is, as you work down the dose response curve, you see what physicians know as the tamoxifen flare. At about a million times beneath that level, you see that the exposure to tamoxifen actually increases the rate of tumor growth. And that's why physicians want to make sure women who are taking tamoxifen don't slip off, because if they slip off, they start moving into this danger zone, okay, where the tumor might actually begin to grow. Bisphenol A is an estrogen. It has a dose response curve very similar to this. But let's pretend in a thought experiment that we are toxicologists, and we're going to set the regulatory standard for tamoxifen based on these experiments. Okay, so what does the toxicologist do? They work down the dose response curve from the right. You see the red ones are marked where there's a significant difference from the control, which is a flat line. They go down until they find a level where there's no effect. And there's a term of art, the no observed adverse effect level. Okay. So then they say, okay, that's where we see no effect. Let's use some safety factors to take into account the fact that rats aren't people. And so they divide by 10. Okay, so you see a safety factor introduced there. Then they take in another safety factor, which is kids aren't adults. So another safety factor. Then they take in a third safety factor, which is that there's variation among people, and they totally divide by about 1,000, which puts them directly in the danger zone. But a toxicologist would have told you, based on their assumptions, that that level is safe. So there's bad news in this message here that we have allowed, by using insensitive approaches, we've allowed compounds to enter our lives that actually are a problem. We use 20th century tools, and we, depending upon them today, we need to modernize them to reflect current science. But there's really good news, which is what I talked about at the beginning. A disease under genetic control may be one caused by environmental factors basically hijacking the genetics of the system. We have the opportunity to prevent those cases of that disease that are caused by these types of events if we understand the science and we act upon it. Right now, we're not acting upon it. Regulations can be improved. That's what this bill is about. We can use these new insights into science to design better products. There are green chemists at work today to try and do exactly that. Our next challenge, we've got a lot of science to do yet. Not all these, we aren't even close to having a full picture of all this, but we already know enough in some cases to begin to incorporate this scientific revolution into a new generation of precautionary health standards and to give better design signals to the chemists who are trying to do it right by incorporating this information in the very design process of the materials they're trying to make. So I thank you very much for allowing me to very rapidly go through a revolution in the environmental health sciences.
Thank you very much. Representative Gallo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Myers, and perhaps to the author as well, excuse me, I'm curious, and first of all, I want to start off by saying I appreciate bringing this forward. I have five kids of my own. How this might or might not be affecting them or even myself as I grow older is at least of curiosity to me, if not concern. But I am wondering, are there scientists, legitimate scientists, who disagree with your findings, that have an alternative perspective on this whole thing? And if so, are we going to hear from any of them today? But perhaps to the first question.
I can certainly answer the first question. Yeah, there is a lively debate underway today in American science about this. It goes in multiple directions. There's little disagreement that what are called epigenetic factors have a major consequence for human health. There's little disagreement that environmental contaminants can alter epigenetic behavior of genes, or control of genes expression. That's the core, that NIH is putting hundreds of millions of dollars into advancing that research issue. There is also significant agreement in the research community, although the medical community, because they're focused largely on treating patients and they legitimately don't have time to keep up with some of these advances, they aren't as aware of where the most recent science has led us in these considerations. There are also disagreements, and we certainly, if any of you were present yesterday at the Senate hearings, we had several industry representatives present who actually agreed quite strongly about some of the specific implications of this research. There's an interesting pattern that emerges as one analyzes the science, and I didn't include this slide in the package. I don't know if there's a table in here that IATP may have agreed, Healthy Legacy may have included. Not in my material. Did you put this? Yeah, there's a table. It wasn't with my material, but the Healthy Legacy people put in, and it shows a curious pattern of results that looks at the likelihood of finding adverse effects as a function of who funds the study. Okay? And this is a pattern that's it. It's a pattern that is seen, if you look at what your hair has. If you look in the pharmaceutical industry, if you look at lead, if you look at tobacco, you look at chemicals, you find that as you break down the studies into those funded by independent agencies versus those funded by people with a big economic stake in the game, those with an economic stake are much less likely to find adverse effects as a result of exposure.
President Gallo.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Murray, that's specifically why I asked about scientists, and I realize some of them are industry scientists,
yeah.
But I was really speaking more to people who might be viewed as more objective on this. And my understanding, again, is that there are those who this is enough advanced and early enough that, it, and the reason I bring this up in a policy committee is, if we're going to base this level of regulation on science, it should be very solid. We should know what we're doing before we do it, kind of.
There is very solid science on the consequences of exposure for children. Very solid science. I was pointing you to where this science is headed, where the next stage of science is, and how exciting it is, and how great it's going to be if we start structuring our public policies around things that incorporate this new emerging science.
Reverend Dowell.
Well, Mr. Chair, and to the author, this bill, as I've been reading it, is crafted very broadly, with all due respect to the science, to the extent that I think it could include any number of chemicals, any number of products, and I don't want to get into the commerce aspect. Although
that's a fair question. That's a health question.
The breadth of this bill is shocking, frankly. With all due respect to the science and the emerging understanding of how these chemicals impact us at very early stages and at very small amounts, to go to a massive regulatory program, which this implies, first of all on a state level and not on a federal level, I just wonder if the author could respond to that. Why such a huge scope for this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the purpose of this bill is to start setting up a system. You know, there's 60,000 60,000 grandfathered in Vitasca, 80,000 in commerce. And we use a whole bunch of filters to kind of reduce the chemicals we're working on down further and further. And when, if you actually look at how many priority chemicals actually subject to regulation, even regulation being reporting and possibly looking for safer alternatives, we're looking for 5 by January 1st of 2011 and 5 by January 1st of 2013. There's not 5 every year thereafter, according to the bill, but they do have to re-look at these chemicals. And I want our agencies, if they're not doing this, if no one's doing this, why aren't they doing it? They need to be looking at the burden of proof is now on our federal, and I would like it to be on our state government to say this is dangerous. If we start looking to proving it's safe, we'd be having a whole different public health outcome, and I don't know if we'd be having a lot of these conversations. And so the chemicals of high concern, that will be a bigger group. That's kind of filtering it down to say these are the ones we need to look at to see if they're in our environment. And so that is the whole purpose of the bill, is to try to get our hands around a level we can actually deal with in a reporting and regulatory manner.
And Dr. Myers, just on that issue, I'll come back. I'm sorry, Steve. You know, the kind of how we're identifying these chemicals and bringing them down. So we're starting with this pool, and you're familiar with the bill?
Basically, but I'm really here to testify on the science. Not
well,
on
and
the
this is going towards that, I think. The question would be, so we have kind of a list of an authoritative body says it's either developmental toxin, cancer, genetic damage, reproductive harm, and then also has to be found in the human body, in dust, air, drinking water, in fish or wildlife, or banned in another state, but kind of without regard to the amount that's found in those places, as I understand it. What do you think about that process?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the details of the bill in that regard.
Okay.
Without regard to the amount?
It would fall into this category without regard to the amount as I read the bill. So if it's found in fish or wildlife, I think in general is how I read the bill. And I'm just wondering, is that kind of move us in the right direction scientifically, or would there be a better way to kind of think about that?
Well, I do think that it's really important to prioritize your list of chemicals based on what is actually observed in people or observed in wildlife, whatever your target organism of concern is. Too often we've devoted a lot of energy on estimating what's in people or what's in wildlife, and now we actually have the chemical tools where you can come up with pretty accurate estimates of measurements of what's in there. It's a very different ballgame. And so using that tool as a means of prioritizing and then not just knowing what's in them, but also knowing some of the toxicology around that's associated with some of those chemicals, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Okay, Rick and Dowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to go on at too much length about this, but I think you got at one of the concerns that I have, and this is a huge funnel. And the implication for having to go out and test the home environment, various products, fish and wildlife, and all that. I see this massive bureaucracy to identify chemicals and then funnel them down into something, when in fact maybe it would be better to start with what we know for sure. If we've got four or five chemicals we're really chiefly concerned with, and that there's good understanding of where they are in the environment and how the alternatives are available and that sort of thing, maybe we could focus on that first. So again, it's not that I'm opposed to what you're trying to do. I think it's just the scope of this is so massive. We're looking at United States Environmental Protection Agency, California Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, World Health Organization. We've had some controversies about that over the last couple of years about whether or not they're the organization to. But you create this massive net to haul in this set of chemicals of concern, and then a process that I don't think is all that clearly defined about how we get it to the point where that's regulated out of stuff and alternatives are included.
So Representative Gallo, we have two more testifiers, which may get it, answer some of those questions as well.
Perhaps the author could answer that
Mr.
issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwald, to be clear, we're not asking the agency to do tests and find in products. They're basically looking to assess and evaluate information that's already out there. I think that's an important aspect of the bill. We're not asking them to create a whole and with all the new science that's going on in toxicology, but there's a lot of information out there that we can assess and evaluate, and we want to do it in a systematic way, and so we're pulling it out. And I think we've seen in the last few years our attempts to regulate chemical by chemical, and you sat through some of these hearings, is my guess, and you may do so again this year. I don't think that's the best way to be regulating chemicals in our that affect our kids and the development of our children. And affect all our health. So I think this is trying to get away from that, sending a single chemical through the legislature. And we've seen that happen on the state level. We passed the phthalates bill this year. It was vetoed, but they've been now banned at the federal level. So there's been attempts at it, but I think we want to get away from doing that in the legislature because it's not an effective use of our time. We're not the science experts who are assessing and evaluating this information.
Mr. Chair, just one quick note. I just want to point out that in Section 3 of the bill, identification of priority chemicals subject to regulation, we've got has been found through sampling, biomonitoring, has been identified. Who's going to be doing this?
Mr. Chair, I know we have a couple more testifiers, but Kathleen Schuler from Healthy Legacy
good.
Can
yes, please answer
help
the
it.
Question. That's great.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the PCA would not be required to conduct additional testing. This would be data that's already out there about contaminants that we know are in wildlife or in the environment. The CDC does an annual biomonitoring testing where they sample people across the country, so the CDC data could be used, and also the biomonitoring program that's been implemented at the health department could be used. So there's no new testing, it's just existing data that would be out there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to keep. I have a few questions for the author, but since the doctor is here, I'll keep them to him quick. But two questions. First of all, thank you for being here. On the list of high-risk chemicals, is mercury on that list?
It certainly should be.
And then, doctor, in your view, is mercury that's in vaccines covered by something like this? It's an issue that I've been working on, and I know that there's diversity of opinion in this room about that issue. I wondered if, in your view, that issue should be or is covered by this type of legislation.
I would not expect it to be covered by this type of legislation. I'd have to ask the authors of the bill about that. It's a very controversial subject. There is a diversity of scientific opinion about it. Do you want to answer the question about the bill?
Yeah, the intention of the bill is not to cover pharmaceutical or medical products, but it would be covering other consumer products.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then I guess I'm looking at the definitions of the bill in the definition section, and when the way I read the definition of children's product, it means a consumer product intended for use by children, and it doesn't limit the realm of possibilities to just children's toys, baby products, car seats. It seems to me that that creates a floor, not a ceiling, in terms of the products covered. And so when I look at my reading of that definition, it opens things up to all children's products. So my question to you would be, if you want to move in the direction of making children safe, why would mercury and vaccines not be covered by your legislation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Broad, I think there are other health concerns, and I think this is an issue I'd be happy to keep talking about with you, and I think there are other considerations in the mercury and vaccine, other considerations on that issue, and I think that's another debate we have started to have and will, I'm sure, continue to have in the legislature as a public health issue in terms of the possible effects of mercury and vaccine as well as the public health effects of preventing disease.
And I think that it strikes me that the analysis of if a safer alternative exists would probably come into play at some point in that analysis, you know, in the bill.
And Mr. Chairman, that leads to my next question related to the safe or replacement chemicals and alternatives that are out there, Doctor. You know, when Representative Knuth said something that it's the state's responsibility, the federal responsibility to prove that they're safe, and it would seem to me that I must have heard you wrong. That was related to a separate question that somebody had asked. And it seems to me that all of these products at one point proved that they were safe at that point until science has shown something else. And so my question to you, Doctor, is related to these replacement products that are out there. How have they proven that they're safe long term?
Yeah.
You know, it seems like we have a known quantity here and we're going to shift to an unknown quantity. And I think about some of the products like car, just as an add-on to that question, car seats. I'm wondering, how does a car seat impact a child? I just honestly am trying to figure that out. Or is it about when that car seat is done and the disposal of it?
Yeah. Hopefully the car seat protects the child from impact.
Mr. Chairman, Doctor, thank you.
Yeah.
But what I'm talking about is related to the chemical use in the plastic that is protecting the child.
You are striking right at the core of the hardest part about this issue. But I think you're wrong about one aspect, and that is that the products that we are using have not been proven safe. Most of them have hardly been tested at all with any serious science. Okay. Most of them. The vast majority of chemicals have not been tested.
And Mr. Chairman and Doctor, have the replacement products been tested?
Some to the degree that the products are replacing, but many have not either. And that's why this whole issue of green chemistry is so important, because we have to get the testing taking place much earlier in the process of product design. That's where the whole issue comes down to.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Doctor, then I'm confused at the replacement chemicals being used as the alternative to chemicals. I'm trying to understand how you can move to something that we don't know is effective or safe, just simply because we don't like the ones we have. I don't understand.
Well,
the thing.
It presumes testing of those materials.
Okay, and I think there's a couple of questions that were in there, which is, for instance, if it's in a car seat, how do we know that it's going to actually that there's going to be exposure to a child? But what I'd like to do is actually get to the other two testifiers, and then we can try to come back.
I just finished my loop of questioning. Representative Knuth, to suggest that not allowing mercury in vaccines to be considered as part of this legislation, in my view, is absolutely. I mean, if you're going to try to protect, if that's the goal, then you should try to protect in a broader sense. I mean, this is a pretty broad bill, and I would argue that actually I think vaccines are covered under your bill. Your definition of consumer products is absolutely, I think it covers all products that are sold to children, the way I read your definition, but I would think that you would want to have mercury and vaccines covered in your bill. When you talk about other things being part of that discussion, well, I would think that car seats would be the same thing. You know, if you're not going to allow people to have car seats, or to have this in car seats, who's to say that the replacement product provides you a safe car seat like we expect? Who's to say that the replacement product provides you a hockey helmet that is going to keep your child from having a concussion? You know, those are the discussions, I think, that if you want to have them, we should have that discussion. But I would hope that you wouldn't close the door to discussing getting mercury out of vaccines, if that's your goal, to protect kids.
Representative Hunt.
I wanted to wait till after the speaker has just given me line for the end.
Representative Levy on this at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to respond because, you know, I think that it's really when you're talking about vaccines as opposed to consumer products, you're talking about a whole different cost-benefit analysis, and you're also talking about a very different federal regulatory scheme and agencies that do this differently. And so, I mean, I don't know the precise answer here, but to say that we should do this with some kinds of products does not exclude that it should be done, but on those other things. But neither does it mean that it should be done all in the same way or under the same bill. So I think there's. It really brings in a lot of other things when you start talking about vaccines as opposed to toys or these other kinds of things.
Well, Mr. Chairman, vaccines go directly into children, and,
right.
And actually I would argue that they're covered under the bill, and I would thank Representative Knuth for covering them in that way.
No, can I just ask a question of the other two testifiers? Who else is going to testify? Are you here? Are you in town? If you could come down and testify, this is what we're going to do, members. We are going to, thank you, Doctor, we are going to actually hear as many of the testifiers as we can. We're going to come back tomorrow and delay another bill to kind of hear. We're going to run out of time here. So I'd like to get the people that can testify in, and then we can have a little more discussion tomorrow on the bill. But we'll get it up. Because we have to be in, out of this committee by tomorrow to get to the floor to get to environment on Thursday. Okay. Thank you. So no one else had a question for Dr. Meyer? Okay. Kelly, Representative.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification, because actually for Ms. Schuler, who answered Representative Gottwald, just on the designation of a high concern priority chemical, you said we're going to use current research that we have. Is that correct? That's where the designations are coming from?
I have to ask the drafters, but my understanding is that it's the case.
Well, then the question is directed at you, Dr. Friedman.
Sir,
you said we're in a midstream and a scientific revolution of how we're looking at this research,
right,
and how these chemicals are being derived. So I'm just confused as to which research we're using to make these designations.
Scientific research is always in the state of change. It's always in the state of change. And we use that which scientific bodies reach a consensus about as to their potential risks. And science is always about reevaluating what, so it's never in stasis. So we use the best science that we have at the time. And right now there's some products that I think science is already telling us we need to act on a precautionary basis. And there are other products where it isn't there yet. And so we have to be continuously evaluating what has reached a stage of application.
And doctor, I don't know, I don't want to put more work on you, but one thing that would be valuable, you don't have to do it now, but as you maybe when you get someplace, you can take some time just to look at the language of the bill, and there's some specific lists that are identified. Mm-hmm. It would be interesting to kind of get your perspective on where those lists sit within kind of Representative Kelly's question.
Thank
Does
you.
That make sense?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. If we could just go to the next testifier.
Hi.
Thank you. Welcome.
I need to speak into this,
or? If you could, and please identify yourself as well.
Hi there. My name is Heidi Mitchell. Heidi Mitchell, that's my maiden name. I am a nurse, but most importantly, I'm a mother of 7-year-old twins. And immediately after finding out that I was pregnant with my twins, I was quite aware of all the toxins in our everyday environment. My neighbor putting lawn chemicals on, sitting behind a bus with exhaust. I try to hold my breath just in case that tiny little bit of exposure from the bus might do something to my babies. I was increasingly frustrated trying to find out information about all these things. When my twins were born, I was not prepared for how my life would change. We were exhausted taking care of these two beautiful innocent beings. We wanted as parents, as all parents do, the best for them, and it was very apparent that it would be a struggle to find out what that best was.
especially in the products that we were using for them. Every product we needed to purchase for them became a huge learning experience, and with the time it took just to make healthy choices for them, I became increasingly resentful of the companies that didn't have two crying, hungry babies on their lap while they were making choices about what chemicals they were going to put in their products. I cannot tell you how many times we brought something home and found out that it contained something harmful, and we subsequently threw them away or disposed of them properly, probably thousands of dollars worth of things, pacifiers, toys, and even furniture from the kids. It was terrifying watching them explore their world when they would put things in their mouths, crawl around in innocence to the hazards that were around them. And as their mother, I became almost paranoid because it seemed that even the products that appeared safe were not necessarily safe. Parents should not have to worry that a product designed for their child is safe. As consumers, the cost of the item should contain the cost that ensures their safety. I want the moms, the dads, and the caregivers in Minnesota to rest, knowing that the bottles and the things that they are giving their children are not going to cause them harm in the future. Where is the long-term commitment of the companies making products to ensure that the reason a child has an illness, cancer, learning difficulty is not because the child sucked on that product when they were a little baby? Parenting is a wonderful thing. Please support this bill. It makes it safer for children and easier to spend time enjoying our children and not fearing for them. Thank you.
Any questions, members? Okay. Thank you. Thank you for coming down today. I appreciate it. And unfortunately, we have about 5 minutes.
Well, for those of you who were at the Senate hearing yesterday, it was about the same situation.
Okay.
My name is Kathleen Roberts. I'm with the American Chemistry Council. The American Chemistry Council represents the leading chemical manufacturers in the United States. These are the companies that are engaged in the business of chemistry.
Are you around tomorrow?
No, sir, I'm sorry.
Okay,
I'm not.
Then go ahead. Thanks.
Our members apply the science of chemistry to make innovative products and services that make people's lives better, healthier, and safer. Recognizing the context of time, I'm going to try to highlight some of the things in my testimony. I want to make it clear that certainly I, as a parent, also recognize the importance of protecting our kids from all kinds of risks. ACC, as a trade association, supports the objectives of protecting children from harmful exposures to chemicals. Our members have participated in programs where we've developed data and put it out onto the public domain through an EPA website called the HPVIS information, it's called the HPVIS, HPV information system. We've also worked with EPA under the Voluntary Children's Chemical Evaluation Program, a program specifically to set up to better understand how exposures to children can best be assessed. Because as the mom who went before me points out, children are different than adults. They're on the floor. They're putting things in their mouth. Exposures are different. We've also been a long-time supporter of the National Children's Health Study, a long-term study of all the environmental factors, including diet, economic status, and possible chemical exposures that can influence children's health in the U.S. We're certainly supportive of legislation that improves transparency in the information about chemicals used in products, including children's products. This helps parents, educators, and the government make better decisions. We support legislation that focuses on identifying and assessing priority chemicals. We do have concerns, however, with the legislation as it's currently proposed, and I think a number of those concerns have actually already been touched on. One thing we're concerned about is right now the proposed bill really only focuses on hazard and does not have any discussion on exposure potential. So, for example, the discussion on a car seat. If you have a chemical, a monomer that's a residue of the polymer that's used to make the plastic, that's used to make the frame of the car seat in your car, are the kids really going to be exposed to that residual monomer? And if so, what's the concentration of that? Important to understand these things because you want to prioritize what chemicals you're going to decide to assess. As Dr. Myers points out, science is a long and complicated process, and so you want to prioritize and work on those chemicals and the potential exposures first. Recognizing the high priority chemicals and as they're listed, we just want to point out that the mere presence of a chemical in a substance doesn't necessarily mean exposure. As I just said, you might have something that's wrapped up in a matrix of a plastic. to us, we would certainly suggest that that's not something that you would want to chase after immediately. The listing of the high production volume chemicals as priority chemicals, the high production volume chemicals is a reporting that occurs under the US EPA TSCA regulation. It is simply a report of how much is produced. It is not necessarily a surrogate of exposure. It is certainly not a surrogate of whether it's used in the child's product, and if it is used in the child's product, what the exposure of that is. Again, as it's already been pointed out, ACC has some significant concerns about this alternative that would be used. Right now, as the legislation defines an alternative as something that's functionally equivalent, but it does not go into whether that is the same quality, whether it's feasible to replace it, what the risks or costs are. If you think of chemistry as cooking, sometimes you can substitute one ingredient for another and not impact the quality of the final product. As someone who suffered from weight issues forever, you can't use applesauce in every baked good, despite what some of the dietary magazines will tell you. It doesn't taste the same. It's the same situation. You simply can't pull out one chemical and insert another and expect to have the same quality. We're also concerned because we would certainly want any assessment done on an alternative chosen to replace a priority product. That assessment should be as robust as the initial assessment on that initial priority chemical. Alternative assessment is a new and evolving science, and whether the Minnesota PCA has that expertise and resources to do that is certainly something that I would hope that they would comment on. But that would be a concern that we'd have because, again, it is a new and up-and-coming program.
Can I just ask two questions, yes, Chris? One is a question about this document. Okay. Can you just address that? Because it seems like a pretty compelling.
I honestly haven't seen the chart, but I can comment on Dr. Meyer's point. When industry is required to do studies and report them in under regulatory requirements, we have stringent requirements that are put on us, good laboratory practices. There's a number of parameters that must be followed in order to make sure that the data that are developed are done so in a scientifically valid way. I also think, although people may question, why does industry do these studies? Well, why shouldn't they? They're the ones that are producing the product and putting out in the public domain. They have a responsibility to test those products. So that's why you have those industry funded. For those researchers that are not required to follow the same government guidelines because they're not compelled for compliance purposes, they don't have the same stringent requirements. And I think the reality is, in this day and age, everyone has an economic interest in research that's done, whether it's done by industry or whether it's done by a foundation or funded by an NGO group. Whatever the outcome of those, there are economic impacts for each of those groups.
Okay, and it looks like Dr. Myers has, maybe if we can talk after, but if we could just submit something to us, is that possible to do? Thank you.
We'd be happy to do that.
Both sides, yeah.
Let me just highlight one other concern that we have with the bill, and I don't know whether it was, let me just point out that the bill does require that when a priority chemical is identified, the manufacturer of the children's product has to report the amount of the priority chemical in each of the products reported to the state, but it seems a little disconnected because there is no threshold associated with whether that priority chemical, so if it's a priority chemical and it's going to have to be substituted, what difference does it make, what concentration it is in that product, you know, why would you have the producers of the product within Minnesota have to accept that additional burden? So I think there's a bit of a disconnect in the bill on that regard. Let me just close by saying protecting kids from risks is important. It's essential. Again, as a mom, I recognize it. I'd like to protect my kids from any potential chemical harm. I'd like to protect my daughter from the mean girls at school. I'd like to protect my son from the slackers he hangs out with right now. But that's part of being a parent, is recognizing that we can't always fix everything. But the science is a complicated and evolving task. It's a Herculean task. And so we just would encourage Minnesota to take the opportunities to be as practical and pragmatic as they can as they approach this. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And we're going to lay House Bill 250 on the table. We're going to take it up tomorrow. We're not going to take up either Representative Murphy's bills tomorrow. So we have time to finish up this. So we'll do the autism bill, and which I think is actually going to be only Representative Norton's. We're not going to hear Representative Slawick's autism bill tomorrow. And then we'll hear Representative Lane's Dula bill and finish this up. So thank you. So we're going to lay House Bill 250 on the table. I don't know if we can just do that. Okay. Thank you. We're adjourned.